about quantum walk and this you know, computational tool that's telling us something about the power of quantum computers. But so I understand this is supposed to be a little bit more of a general audience kind of a talk. So I want to start out by just talking a little bit about quantum computing, you know, why it is that we're interested in quantum computing and what we hope to learn by studying what quantum computers can do using this idea of quantum walks on graphs. Okay. So there are, you know, a couple of reasons that we might be interested in understanding quantum computers and what they can do. And, you know, one such reason is the technological reason, that there are problems that we can solve fast using quantum computers, if we can build them, that we believe that we will not be able to solve efficiently with classical computers. So, you know, the most famous example of this is Shor's algorithm that you've probably all heard about, which, you know, will take some large integer and break it down into its prime factors, a problem that has applications in cryptography, among other things. And maybe you've also heard about Grover's algorithm, which solves this unstructured search problem with not exponential, but quadratic speedup over classical computers. So if you have some sort of unstructured space and you want to search it, you can do that faster using Grover's algorithm than you can using using classical algorithms, in fact, using any classical method. And you know, these are the two best known examples of quantum algorithms, but now there's actually a long list of things that we know how to do fast with a quantum computer that we either think we won't be able to do fast with a classical computer, or in some cases that we can even, you know, prove something about the hardness of solving those problems using a classical computer. So, you know, if we could actually build these devices that would execute these algorithms, then it would have technological implications. Okay. But maybe there are other reasons to care about quantum computers and try to understand you know, what it is that they can do. We can ask just sort of like the basic question of what it is that we can compute efficiently in the world, right? So, you know, we believe, I think we have a well-founded belief that nature is described by quantum mechanics. And so if we want to understand computation, if we want to understand what are the things that can be computed efficiently, then we have to bring quantum mechanics into the picture. And this is not just, you know, an academic observation. I mean, it really seems to be the case that actually we can do some things a lot faster using quantum computers than we could using only classical computers. And so, you know, this it raises the question of what exactly is the nature of that power? What is it that quantum mechanics allows us to do a lot faster than we could do if we could only use classical mechanics to do computations? Now, I should say that, you know, we don't know with absolute certainty that this is the case, that we, you know, that we actually will be able to solve problems faster by taking into account these ideas about quantum computation. But the alternatives are things which, you know, if they were the case, it would be surprising and they would be interesting in their own right. So, you know, there are I think really only two reasonable alternatives to this idea that we can actually use quantum computers to solve some problems fast. One is that maybe we can actually efficiently simulate quantum mechanics with classical computers. Right, so this is something that we don't know how to prove is not the case. It could be that classical computers can efficiently simulate quantum ones. I think that would be a very surprising thing. You know, it would mean, in particular, that there's a fast classical algorithm for factoring, but it would mean much, much more than that. So I think this would be a very surprising outcome. It would be really interesting if we could show that this is the case, but it is a logical possibility. The other possibility, of course, is that, you know, quantum mechanics is not the right description of nature. And this somehow would be, you know, the most interesting possibility, probably, that, you know, if we somehow would learn that we have to revise physics on the basis of computational considerations, I think that would be really astounding and remarkable and a great thing. So if for some reason, you know, we can't build a quantum computer and the reason is because we have to modify quantum mechanics, that would be, I think, you know, maybe technologically you might think of that as a failure, but actually from a scientific perspective, that would be an amazing thing. So there are these possibilities, and there are things that we should think about and that we should take seriously. But, you know, if I had to bet, my money would be on the possibility that we really can build a quantum computer. You know, there's nothing about physics that says that we can't, in principle, build a quantum computer, and that those devices really can do some things better than we can do using only classical computers. So this is, you know, what my research is about. I think about trying to understand what the advantages of quantum computation are over classical computation, you know, and that then sheds some light on quantum mechanics and what it is, you know, what it is about quantum mechanics that differs from classical mechanics, and then we can think about, you know, how to put those differences to use. Okay, and I just want to say a few words also before I get into the more detailed stuff about quantum walks, about the origin of quantum speedup. You know, this is something which is certainly controversial and about which there's no consensus on, you know, where exactly the power of quantum computers comes from. But if I had to point to one thing, then I would probably pick, you know, the fact that we can have interference between different computational paths. And, you know, probably many of you know that in a quantum computation, what we try to do is arrange some sort of a process where paths that lead to the solution to some problem that we'd like to solve will interfere constructively, and paths that lead to non-solutions will interfere destructively. And somehow, if we're able to arrange that interference in a very careful way, you know, in just the right way, then we can potentially have fast algorithms for problems that we couldn't solve efficiently classically. But now you may be thinking, you know, I have this picture of wave interference, and you know, this is a picture of the surface of water, right? These are water waves. So, you know, we have these this kind of interference taking place even in classical wave mechanics. So what is it about quantum mechanics that's really so special? I mean, in principle, we could do some kind of a classical computation by, you know, carefully throwing rocks into a pond in just the right way and then looking to see where the ripples go. And, you know, you could try to do that, but you would not get the kinds of exponential speedups that we get from quantum computers by doing that sort of thing. And that's because, you know, when we represent this sort of interference quantum mechanically, we can have a very efficient representation of potentially very complicated interference phenomena using only a small number of degrees of freedom. So, you know, if you wanted to use these wave effects to implement quantum algorithms through the interference in a lake, you would need an exponentially big lake. But with a quantum computer of only a reasonable size, we can run really fast algorithms. Okay, so that's the kind of very quick introduction to why we should care about quantum computing. And what I want to talk about for most of the talk is this idea of a quantum walk. Okay, so this is an idea that's been developed over the last, well, more than 10 years to come up with new quantum algorithms. So to find speedups of quantum computers over classical computers. And I want to tell you about some ideas that I've been involved with that have led to fast algorithms. Okay. So what is this idea of a quantum walk? Well, the idea is to think about a quantum mechanical analog of a random walk on a graph. Okay, so we have, you know, we can think about stochastic processes where probabilities evolve in some way. And what we'll do in a quantum walk is that we'll replace the probabilities in a stochastic process by quantum amplitudes, okay, which now have the possibility of experiencing interference. And this interference can lead to radically different behavior than if we just looked at stochastic dynamics, right? So, you know, there's an example shown here in this picture where we consider a random walk or a quantum walk on a line, right? So in one dimension. And if you consider the usual sort of, you know, classical random walk on a line, surely you're familiar with what happens, right? If you run for a number of steps t, then the expected distance that you move goes like the square root of t, right? And you go into some kind of distribution that looks basically like a Gaussian, and the width of it grows like the square root of the number of steps that the walk has been running for. So that's what's shown at the top. And you can define a natural quantum analog of that process, a quantum walk on a line. And what happens when you do that is you find that in a number of steps, if you take a number of steps equal to t, then the distance that you move is proportional to t, not just proportional to the square root of t. So the walk moves faster. So this is the kind of thing that we see when we take classical walks and we turn them into quantum walks. We see sometimes very different behavior, sometimes even more different behavior than we see here. But, you know, this is maybe not so surprising by itself, right, that we can have very different behavior when we look at a very different process. What's maybe more surprising is that we can take this very different behavior and we can use it to some kind of computational advantage. So, for example, there's this paper that we wrote now more than 10 years ago, where we showed an example of an exponential speedup using a quantum walk. So we considered some kind of graph, which is shown here, and we showed that there's a computational problem defined in terms of this graph that you can solve using a quantum walk in polynomial time, but actually in the model that we consider, which is a black box model where we can actually prove lower bounds, we can prove that no classical algorithm will be able to solve this problem in polynomial time. Actually, any classical algorithm will take exponential time. So, you know, a classical random walk trying to solve this problem would take exponential time. But in fact, an even stronger statement is true. Any classical process would need to take an exponential amount of time to solve the same problem. So, you know, this example showed that quantum walks are, in principle, computationally powerful. And the things that I want to talk about in the rest of the talk are examples of maybe more interesting problems where we could see some speed up and where we could use that to solve some computational task. All right, so let me first, though, just be a little bit more precise about what I mean by a quantum walk on a graph. So we can consider a graph, which is, you know, some set of vertices that are joined by some edges. And we can specify that graph in terms of matrices. So a natural matrix that describes the graph is what's called the adjacency matrix, where we have ones in the positions corresponding to edges of the graph. So the, you know, the basis states in the space where the walk takes place will be the vertices of the graph. And this is a matrix that acts in that space. And then we can consider another matrix closely related to the adjacency matrix, which is called the Laplacian, which is just minus the adjacency matrix plus a diagonal matrix that has the degrees of the vertices on the diagonal, right? So for example, the vertex labeled 1 has degree 2 in this picture, right? There are two edges coming into that vertex, and that's the reason why there's a 2 in the top left entry of the Laplacian. Okay, so this is a matrix that captures some information about the graph. And now in terms of this matrix, we can define stochastic processes and also quantum processes that respect the structure of the graph. So if we want to define a continuous time random walk on the graph, we could do that as follows. So we, you know, the state of the walk at some time t will just be described by some probability distribution, where there's a probability pv of t to be at vertex v at time t. And the dynamics of the walk are just the, you know, given by the diffusion equation, right? So so the time derivative of the vector of probabilities is just the Laplacian of the graph. So we're in a sort of a discrete space that's described by this graph, but it's really a lot like, you know, the diffusion equation, say, on some continuous manifold. So we have the time derivative of the vector of probabilities is just the Laplacian matrix acting on the vector of probabilities. And this is a, you know, probability conserving process, and it defines some local dynamics of the probabilities on the graph. Okay. All right, so that's a continuous time random walk on a graph. And then we can define a quantum analog of that process. We can define a quantum analog of that process by, first of all, replacing the probabilities by amplitudes. So now we have some amplitude AV of t to be at vertex V at time t. And the dynamics are just given by the Schrodinger equation, right? So it's just exactly the same equation as we had for the random walk, but we put an I on the left-hand side. And now we have, you know, the Schrodinger equation, where the Hamiltonian is just the Laplacian of the graph. And so this, you know, gives us some valid quantum dynamics. And it, of course, can be very different than the corresponding stochastic dynamics, because now we can have interference. Right? And as I said, what we would like to do is we would like to take this idea and we would like to use it to define algorithms, to come up with algorithms that solve problems faster than we can do with a classical algorithm. All right, so I want to tell you about three different things that have been done using quantum walks. So this is all, you know, these are all different pieces of work that I've been involved with. The first is a quantum algorithm for evaluating Boolean formulas. So, you know, a problem that, I mean, it's really a problem from computer science, a very kind of natural problem of evaluating a Boolean formula on some input. But it actually turns out that ideas from physics are very useful in understanding how you should do this in an optimal way on a quantum computer. And then the second problem I want to tell you about is, well, really a quantum mechanical problem. It's the original problem for which quantum computers were proposed, the problem of simulating quantum physics. This is something that, you know, it's like the problem that quantum computers are naturally just want to solve. And I want to tell you about some improved algorithms for doing that with a quantum computer that use this idea of quantum walk. And then the last thing I'll talk about is a way of using a quantum walk to do actually a completely general quantum computation. So a way of mapping computation as we usually think about it in the circuit model into a quantum walk on a graph. All right. So let's start with this task of formula evaluation. All right, so I'm going to think about this task in a model that people often consider in quantum computing, also in classical complexity, which is called the black box model or the query model. So in this model, we've got some input string, but we're not given that input explicitly. It's not given to us as a string, you know, written down on a piece of paper or a magnetic tape or a CD or something like that. It's given to us as a black box that we have to query in order to get information about the input. Right, so we can query the ith bit of the string, and then the black box will tell us, you know, the bit x of I. Right? And we also have some way of doing this on a quantum computer if we think about quantum query complexity, and then we'll be allowed to make queries in superposition. Of course, that will be the difference between what we can do classically and quantumly. All right, and now in query complexity, what we would like to do is we would like to compute some function of x, some function of this black box string, using as few queries as possible. right? So if it's an n-bit string, then obviously, you know, if you make n queries, you know the whole string, so you can compute any function of x making no more queries, right? So the maximal query complexity of any function is just n. And when we talk about query complexity, at least the coarsest measure we can use is just to think only about the number of queries that we make and not worry about the cost of any other computational steps. So, you know, of course, you can worry about the cost of those other things if you like, but you know, maybe to keep things simple, we'll just talk about the query complexity, right? So the query complexity of a problem where the input is an n-bit string is always at most n, but sometimes it could be dramatically smaller than n. And in general, we'd like to understand what it is. All right. So, you know, one particular kind of formula, one particular kind of function of the input string that we could think about would be one that's expressed in terms of a Boolean formula, right? So a formula is, you can think of as being represented by some kind of a tree where the bits of the input string are written at the leaves of the tree. And then the internal vertices of the tree correspond to some kind of logic gates acting on their children, right? So in this picture, they're either AND or OR gates. And, you know, each of these gates, you can evaluate its children, and then you can evaluate the formula up to the root of the tree, which is the value that you would like to output. So here we would like to output the value that's at this top gate, you know, this OR gate, which represents the value of the formula, the final output. Okay, so now a question we can ask is, either using a classical computer or using a quantum computer, how many queries do you have to make to evaluate any particular formula? So this one or any other formula that you might be given. Okay, well, the simplest case of this kind of formula evaluation problem is probably the case of a single OR gate, right? You just have one OR gate, and you would like to evaluate that on the n-bit string that's the input. So this is, you know, you can think about this as being like the problem of deciding whether there's a 1 in the input, right? Because the OR of the input string is going to be 0 exactly when the input string is the 0 string, right? If there's any 1 in the input string, then the value will be 1. Okay. So the classical query complexity of this problem is just kind of obviously linear in the number of input bits. There's no way of knowing whether the string is the all 0 string or not without querying a constant fraction of the input bits. But, you know, one of the very surprising things about quantum computing is that actually you can do a lot better, right? So there's a quantum algorithm, which is this algorithm of Grover that I mentioned before, that will get by with only like the square root of the number of input bits. So this is only a polynomial improvement, you know, it's only a quadratic advantage that we get in this case from quantum computers, but it's nevertheless, I think, quite surprising and turns out to be useful in a lot of applications. Okay, and in fact, this algorithm turns out to be optimal, so it was proven. In fact, even before the algorithm was discovered, that the best you could do was to get by with, you know, some constant times square root of n queries to solve this problem. All right. So that's one example of the formula evaluation problem, but it's only one very specific example. You know, you can ask now, what if we take some other formula? What can we say about how many queries we need to make in order to evaluate the formula? Well, one particular other class of formulas that turns out to be of interest is what are called balanced binary AND OR trees, right? So these are the formulas that you get when you take alternating levels of AND and OR gates, and every gate is just, it just takes two inputs, right? So, and you know, the tree is balanced, so we have just this complete binary tree representing the formula. Okay, so now if we have N input bits, of course, N here will be some power of 2 because of the structure of the tree, but if we have N input bits, then you could ask, again, how many queries do you need to make to evaluate the formula? Okay, now it turns out in this case that if you think about a classical algorithm, if you think about a randomized classical algorithm, you actually can do better than evaluating the whole input string. I mean, you might think you would always need to know the whole input for a classical computer to get the answer out, but that's not actually right. I mean, sometimes you can get by with dramatically fewer queries. The reason here is basically because, you know, if you're trying to evaluate an AND gate, well, if you evaluate one of the inputs and you see that it's a 0, you know, then you already know what the value of the AND gate is. You don't need to go evaluate the other input. And you can take advantage of that sort of thing if you evaluate the formula in a sort of clever randomized way. Okay, so it's known that actually the optimal classical algorithm for evaluating these formulas has complexity that goes like about n to the 0.753. So this number comes from solving some two-term recursion. Okay, so so that's the best classical algorithm, but then you can ask, how well can you do with a quantum computer? And so it's been known for quite some time that the best, that you can't do any better than the square root of n. So the best you could hope for would be the kind of advantage that you get from Grover's algorithm, that instead of n you need square root of n. And actually, this lower bound holds for completely arbitrary AND/OR formulas. So, so this was proven by Barnum and Sachs in 2002. Okay, but this still you know, leaves the question, how well can you do? And in fact, for many years, the best known quantum algorithm for this problem was the classical algorithm, right? I mean, of course, the classical algorithm is in particular a quantum algorithm. And it's not because people didn't think about this question. I mean, people realized that this was an important question. But still, for many years, the best, I mean, we just knew no better quantum algorithm than the best classical algorithm. Until a kind of breakthrough result that occurred in 2007 by Farhi, Goldstone, and Gutman, which showed how to evaluate this formula a lot faster using a quantum computer. And they used a very surprising idea, which was to connect this formula evaluation problem to a problem of scattering. So, you know, an idea that would be, you know, something you maybe would expect to hear about in a talk on high energy physics. But, you know, it turns out to be a useful idea here to think about evaluating Boolean formulas. So the idea is more or less the following. Let me just kind of sketch the basic ideas. So you can, first of all, consider a graph that's an infinite path. And on such a graph, you can make a quantum state that corresponds to a wave packet that wants to move with momentum k. You can describe such a state. And now what they say is, OK, well, let's attach to that graph a binary tree that represents the Boolean formula that we'd like to evaluate. And then at the leaves of that tree, we would like to somehow encode an input string, this black box string of zeros and ones. And now a way of doing that, you know, one way you might try to do that would be by modifying the tree so that every place that there's an input bit that's a one, you put an extra edge to an extra vertex. So now we have a graph that depends on the input. And then you could try to understand what happens when you let the system evolve, when you perform the quantum walk on this graph. And what happens, you know, what they showed is that if you take the right kind of wave packet, so for small momenta, it will turn out that the wave will be transmitted if the formula evaluates to zero and reflected if the formula evaluates to one. So somehow this scattering process is exactly telling you about what is the value of the formula. And if you go in and look at the details about, you know, how many queries this corresponds to in some query algorithm, what you can show is that you need about square root of n queries to evaluate this formula. So you can actually saturate this lower bound. Okay. So on the other hand, this algorithm, you know, as it was originally stated, was just for this case of the balanced binary AND/OR tree. You know, the simple strategy that they described does not immediately work for general Boolean formulas. So there's many other formulas out there besides the, you know, the single OR gate and the balanced binary AND/OR tree. You know, so we can ask, what should the complexity be for arbitrary formulas? So it turns out that you can turn this basic kind of idea into a general algorithm. You know, there are several steps that you have to go through. So first of all, you have to make the formula somehow close to balanced, and you can rewrite general formulas so that they are approximately balanced. This is something that actually people have known how to do for a long time. The really key change that you have to make is to assign some edges, some weights to the edges of the tree, which are chosen in such a way that the scattering process or some other way of getting out spectral information about the tree will tell you something about the value of the formula. And then what you can do is you can indeed show that some spectral information about this graph, so you know the eigenvectors of the graph, are related in a simple way to the function value. Okay, so the particular kind of choice of weights that we made is shown here. You can choose the weights on the edges to be something like the fourth root of the ratio of the subtree sizes. So if you have some vertex V here and its parent P here, you know there's some subformula under V that has some size. There's some number of leaves in the subformula under V. There's in general more leaves in the subformula under P because it could have some other children that are not shown here. And if you take that ratio of the subtree sizes and you take the fourth root, you know that gives you some weight that you could assign to that edge. So now we have, you know, instead of just the adjacency matrix of this graph, we have some matrix where we have values other than one where there are edges. We have these weights. And what you can show is that if you make this choice, then some spectral information about the graph will tell you something about whether the formula evaluates to zero or one. So the specific kind of thing that we show is shown here in this box. So you know, if you have a formula that evaluates to zero, then there's some eigenstate that corresponds to that you can detect by a quantum process called phase estimation. And on the other hand, if the formula evaluates to one, then there'll be no such eigenstate And so, you know, the kind of information you would get out of phase estimation would be quite different, and so you can distinguish these two cases. Okay. So then what we show through this kind of argument is that the quantum query complexity is square root of n, you know, basically square root of n, for a completely arbitrary AND/OR formula. So it doesn't matter what tree is given to you. It doesn't matter how these AND and OR gates are organized. The query complexity is always the square root of n. And this is in contrast to the classical case where actually, you know, the situation is just messy. I mean, I've shown you examples of formulas that have query complexity n and that have query complexity n to the 0.753, and you can get anything in between, right? Whereas with a quantum algorithm, you know, if we think about quantum computation, actually the picture is a lot simpler. The answer is always the square root of n. It just doesn't matter what the formula is. So that's kind of nice. And there's some technical detail here about, you know, we didn't quite prove that the answer was square root of n in this original work that I'm referring to, although this was subsequently improved, and now we really know that the answer is just, you know, exactly the square root of n. Okay, so that's this algorithm for formula evaluation. So next I want to tell you about a completely different application of quantum walks, which is to the problem of simulating quantum mechanics. Okay, so you know, this is again some problem that, you know, it's maybe not clear a priori what it should have to do with quantum walks on graphs, but it turns out that you can use ideas from quantum walks on graphs to give interesting quantum simulation algorithms. All right. So you know, this problem, as I said before, of simulating quantum physics is the problem that really motivated people first to think about quantum computers, right? So Feynman was one of the people who in the 80s, you know, famously talked about this idea that if you wanted to simulate quantum mechanics, well, if you had a computer that was itself quantum mechanical, that would be the right sort of device to get around the problem that, if you know, representing the quantum state on a classical computer is not a tractable thing, right? And you know, Feynman said, by golly, it's a wonderful problem because it doesn't look so easy. But you know, now we know how to do this, you know, how to simulate quantum mechanics efficiently with quantum computers. And in fact, we really understand quite well some of the subtleties of, you know, what the best possible algorithms are, and that's what I want to tell you about here. Okay, so you know, there are various reasons for being interested in this problem of simulating quantum mechanics. The obvious one, perhaps, is that you might want to understand what happens in some particular system, and you might like to do that through a simulation, right? So this is the kind of thing that we do all the time using classical computers, but we could maybe do those sorts of things better using quantum computers. Say if we wanted to understand, you know, the dynamics of chemical reactions, or you know, whether some material is a superconductor, or, you know, some sort of question like that. So those are things we could try to do. But there are other reasons to be interested in simulating quantum mechanics that have to do more with just understanding what you can do with quantum algorithms. So there are many quantum algorithms that are described in terms of Hamiltonian dynamics. And if you want to implement those quantum algorithms in the quantum circuit model, well, that's exactly this quantum simulation problem, right? So for example, you may have heard about adiabatic quantum computation. If you want to simulate that with a universal quantum computer, then what you need is exactly the sort of quantum simulation algorithm that I'm going to describe. All right, so the problem that we'd like to solve here is to simulate the dynamics of a quantum system, which are described by the Schrodinger equation. And so what we have in this quantum simulation problem is some kind of description of what the Hamiltonian is, and I'll say more in a minute about what sort of description we have, but somehow we have the Hamiltonian. We have a time that we want to evolve for, and then we have some initial quantum state, and what I want to imagine is that actually we have a copy of that unknown quantum state in our quantum computer, right? So actually the input to this problem is a quantum state. So that's something we could have in our quantum computer. And then what we would like to do is we would like to produce an output that is also a quantum state. We'd like to produce the final state psi of t, and you know, in general, we'll allow ourselves to make some error as long as that error is small. Okay, so this is a problem where, if you think about the problem in the right way, we can get an advantage over classical computation. But as I've described the problem so far, we can't even really think about this as a problem that we could present to a classical computer, because I said that the input and the output were quantum mechanical things, right? And so a classical computer couldn't even represent the state efficiently. So what do we mean when we say that this is a problem where we have a quantum speedup? Well, you know, we can think about situations where the initial state is something that has a concise description that we could, you know, in principle write down, and where the sort of information we want to get out at the end of the day is some sort of a simple measurement, like we want to perform some sort of local measurement on the final state. And there are situations like that where You perform measurements on the final state, and the initial state also can be described in a nice way, where a quantum computer can run these quantum simulation algorithms and, of course, can produce the output data that you would like. And we think that those sorts of problems are classically hard. Okay, so those are the sorts of things that we would like to do using quantum simulation, where we would get some advantage over classical computation. But you know, we can also just think about this quantum simulation problem as sort of a quantum subroutine, where what we're trying to do is implement some unitary transformation that corresponds to solving the Schrodinger equation. Okay. Now, there's another issue that we have to talk about a little bit, which is how is the Hamiltonian represented, right? So you know, it could be some local Hamiltonian that could be written down explicitly in terms of you know, the way that you know, some local terms that act on some spins in the quantum system. But there's a more general framework that people often think about when they think about this Hamiltonian simulation problem, which is the framework of what are called sparse Hamiltonians. So in this setting of sparse Hamiltonians, we have some upper bound on how many non-zero entries we could have in any row of the Hamiltonians, let's say D. So here's a sparse Hamiltonian with D equals 4, where the colors represent the different values in the Hamiltonian. And we have an assumption that we have some sort of efficient procedure that will tell us what the entries of the Hamiltonian are like, right? We still can't, you know, even though the Hamiltonian is sparse, we can't imagine that we have a full description of the Hamiltonian that's written out on a piece of paper, because that's an exponentially large thing, right? There's still exponentially many non-zero entries in the whole matrix. It's just that in any given row, there's only D, or at most D. But what we'll assume is that we have an efficient procedure that allows us to compute the locations and values of the non-zero entries in any row that we might care about. So we might say, okay, I'm interested in the fourth row, and I want to know what's the first non-zero entry. And this, you know, this, we have some kind of a subroutine that we can run that will tell us, okay, the first non-zero entry is there, and you know, the value of that matrix element is 17 or you know, whatever it is, right? So, so this is the sort of assumption that we have some kind of concise description of this exponentially large object. Okay, and what we know now is that you know, you can give efficient simulations of Hamiltonian dynamics for such Hamiltonians, and actually there are many different simulation algorithms that are known. The most straightforward approach is one that's been known for quite some time, which is to use what are called product formulas. So like Lee, Trotter, Suzuki, those are the sorts of names that are associated with these product formulas. Okay, so the strategy here is as follows. So we could think about first writing the Hamiltonian as a sum of terms, where each of them is somehow simple. So you know, one way it could be simple would be if it's one sparse. So it's a sparse Hamiltonian with only one non-zero entry in any given row. And that's something that we could just sort of directly simulate by brute force. So that would be something that would be very nice. And there's a way of coming up with such a decomposition for any such for any sparse Hamiltonian using some idea that has to do with distributed edge coloring of the graph. I'm not going to get into the details, but there's some way of coming up with such a decomposition. And then, you know, the main idea is that you can then recombine these terms using these product formulas. So, you know, we know that even if A and B could be non-commuting matrices, nevertheless, the exponential of A plus B is well approximated by some small exponential of A times some small exponential of B, you know, and if you go back and forth enough times, this gives you a good approximation of the exponential of the sum. Okay, so this is, you know, this is a way of simulating sparse Hamiltonians, and in fact, you know, this will give you efficient simulations in the sense that the algorithms will be polynomial time. But there are some things which are maybe not totally desirable about this approach. So the best algorithm of this kind that's known has a complexity, so a number of elementary computational steps, which is, first of all, superlinear in the amount of time that you want to evolve for. So it grows faster than linearly in the amount of time that the Hamiltonian is supposed to be running, which seems like, you know, maybe not as good as you would like, because, well, somehow the system can simulate itself running for time t and time t. So, you know, why can't you do as well in a computer simulation? And also, the dependence on the sparsity is like the cube, which is, you know, sort of a not too small power, and we would like to maybe do better if we could. Okay. So it turns out that there's an algorithm based on ideas from quantum walks, which allows you to improve both of these things. So to explain, you know, what the I'm only going to explain at a very high level what the idea is, but to even do that, I have to take a little bit of a detour and tell you about discrete time quantum walks. Right? So far I've talked about a continuous time quantum walk on a graph, but you could also ask, you know, is it possible to define a discrete time process? Right? So when you think about random walks on graphs, the most common model that people think about is it is a discrete time process where, you know, let's say you start at the origin of the line, and then, you know, you take a step, and in one step, you, you know, with probability a half, you move to the left, and with probability a half, you move to the right. And, you know, that's a discrete time process. That's the sort of standard definition of a random walk. You can define random walks in continuous time, as I did before, but kind of the more conventional way of doing it actually is to consider a discrete time process. So why not do that with a quantum computer? Why did I, you know, start out by introducing things in terms of a continuous time process? Well, it turns out that it's a little bit more tricky to define a continuous time quantum a discrete time quantum walk, because in general, these principles of locality, that you want the locality properties of the walk to respect the structure of the graph, you only want to have non-zero amplitude to move between adjacent vertices. That constraint and the constraint of unitarity, that whatever process you have, if it's a quantum mechanical process, has to be a unitary process, those principles are incompatible. So it's not possible to define a walk that takes place on the space of the vertices of the graph and at the same time as unitary, at least for general graphs. But it turns out, a simple workaround, which is to define a walk not on the vertices of the graph, but on the directed edges or the arcs of the graph. And this is what's sometimes called a coined quantum walk. Okay, so one such definition was given by Mario Segedi in 2005. This is kind of maybe the most popular definition of a discrete-time quantum walk, and you know the details are explained in this box, but maybe the precise details won't be so important for this talk, but there's some way of defining such a process. And what you get out of this is a quantum analog of any Markov process. So for any Markov chain that you might write down, you can write down a quantum analog. Okay, so now what we can do in order to use this idea for Hamiltonian simulation is the following. So I'm just going to outline the basic idea, and you know, I'm happy to take more questions about it, but here I just want to give you sort of a flavor for how these sorts of simulations work. So first of all, you can define some sort of analog of this discrete-time quantum walk that Segedi wrote down, not for an arbitrary stochastic matrix, but for an arbitrary Hamiltonian. So you can follow, you know, a very analogous procedure, but where instead of being given a stochastic matrix, you just take some Hamiltonian that's given to you. And then if the thing that you start with is a sparse Hamiltonian, then actually it will be easy to perform steps of this discrete-time quantum walk. So if you just want to perform one step of the walk, that'll be something which is very easy to do. You can do that with a very small circuit. And then what you can do is you can show that the spectrum of this discrete-time quantum walk, this Segedi operator that you can write down, is closely related to the spectrum of the original Hamiltonian. So, you know, there'll be some eigenvalues for this walk operator, which is some unitary operator, that have a simple relation to the eigenvalues of the original Hamiltonian. And then you can get that information out using a quantum mechanical, a quantum algorithmic process called phase estimation. So that's some way of getting out information about the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of a unitary operator. And once you have the right kind of information about the eigenvalues, you can sort of fix up the difference between the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian and the eigenvalues of the corresponding walk operator and put in the right phase yourself by hand. So this is a very high-level idea of what's going on in this algorithm, but you know, this is the basic idea. And what you can show is that, you know, out of this process, you get an algorithm whose running time is linear in the evolution time. So not superlinear, but really, you know, if you want to evolve the system for time t, you need a number of elementary computational steps that just grows linearly in t. And also it's linear in the sparsity. So, you know, better than this d cubed that you have. And also you can show that the running time of this algorithm is optimal with respect to either of these parameters. So in this black box, in some kind of a black box model of sparse Hamiltonians, you can prove that actually, if you think about just the sparsity alone or just the running time alone, this is really the best you can do. And this is now one of the best known algorithms for simulating sparse Hamiltonians. So if you wanted to actually simulate some physical system, actually in many cases you would be better off using this kind of algorithm than in using this very straightforward algorithm using Trotter formulas. Okay, so that's the second example of something you can do with a quantum walk. The last thing that I want to tell you about is a way of using quantum walks to perform universal quantum computation. Okay, so this way of performing universal quantum computation using quantum walks is also going to use this idea that I mentioned before of scattering theory and thinking about a quantum walk on a graph describing some kind of a scattering process. All right, so how can we do that? Well, you could imagine a situation where we have some kind of a graph, and then we attach semi-infinite paths to some of the vertices of the graph, in this case, two of the vertices. And then you can think about what happens when you send in some incoming wave of momentum k, which is some sort of quantum state supported on one of these semi-infinite paths. If you do that, then at late times, what you'll have is you'll have a transmitted wave and you'll have a reflected wave. And you can compute those transmission and reflection coefficients if you know what the graph is, what this graph g is sitting inside that circle. And more generally, you can consider this kind of scattering scenario where you attach any number of semi-infinite paths to some finite graph. So you choose some subset of the vertices of G, you attach semi-infinite paths to them. Then you can think about what happens if you send a wave of some momentum in on some path. There'll be some outgoing waves in general on all of the paths. And you can do that if you send in the wave from along any one of the incoming paths. And you can collect all of those amplitudes into a matrix, which is called the S matrix. So this is just the sort of analog in this setting of scattering on graphs to the S matrix that you think about in particle physics. In some sense, it's a simpler object here because it's the situation is much more discrete. Okay. So now it turns out that you can actually use these kinds of scattering processes to perform quantum computations and thereby get an alternative model of quantum computation, where instead of thinking about specifying a computation by a circuit, you specify a computation by a graph. So what I'm going to describe is a way of translating the circuit model into this model of quantum walks on graphs, where for any gate in some circuit that we might want to implement, we have some corresponding piece of the graph that implements that. All right, so I want to describe how that works. So here's some way we could think about representing quantum information, first of all. We could consider having a pair of infinite paths. And then we could use what in quantum optics is sometimes called a dual rail encoding, where we encode information in whether our particle is on, whether our walker is on the top path or the bottom path. So our encoded zero state could be a particle of some momentum k moving to the right on the top path. And our encoded one would be a particle with the same momentum on the bottom path. So, and in this kind of construction, we're going to pick some particular momentum k that we're going to work with, and we'll make some choice which is convenient for the sorts of computations that we want to do. All right. So this is a way of encoding information, and now if we want to actually perform a gate, we could try to design some sort of a graph where that the S matrix will implement the desired transformation. Right. So if we want to apply some unitary U to our encoded information. We want the S matrix to somehow reflect that. So what we would like in particular is that the S matrix has, as its bottom left 2x2 submatrix, this matrix U we would like to perform. Where here we're doing a single qubit gate. So U is a 2x2 matrix. This matrix S of K is a 4x4 matrix that describes the scattering among these four semi-infinite paths that are attached to this graph G. And so what you could do is you could try to say, come up with some graph that sits inside here that has the property that it implements some unitary gate that you would like to apply. This is all well and good in principle, but to actually find such things is maybe not so straightforward. So if I tell you what the graph is that sits inside here, it's very easy to compute the S matrix. It's just a problem of solving linear equations. So that's a very easy thing to do. That's exactly the sort of problem that you're familiar with solving from first year quantum mechanics, right? This is just some sort of analog of the square well problem, something like that, right? But so that's straightforward. But to solve the inverse problem of I have some particular U I would like to put down there, and now I want to come up with a graph so that the S matrix corresponding to that graph gives me that U, that problem is a lot harder. I mean, we don't have tools in general for solving that problem. Okay, but it turns out that we actually can find a universal set of gates, by some careful choice, and fortunately it's possible to get by with graphs that are not too big. So here's something that gives you a universal set of single qubit gates. These are just two particular graphs. This one implements this gate. This is what's sometimes called the T gate in quantum computing. And this is some other kind of gate that, has the property that when you put it together with this gate, you get a universal set of single qubit gates in the sense that you can approximate any gate acting on a single qubit as some kind of product of gates of these two forms. Okay, and this is what the S matrix is if you take the logical momentum to be pi over 4. So these wave packets are moving with momentum pi over 4. All right. And now this is a way of doing single qubit gates, but it turns out that there's a quite straightforward way of doing a two qubit gate that makes this set universal. If you encode the n qubit states in an appropriate way, then actually the two qubit gates are just trivial because this amounts to just swapping the wires in an appropriate way. And you can implement sequences of gates by just you know, plugging these graphs together. And the result is that if you have any circuit on n qubits, then you can simulate that by some graph. Now, this graph will in general be exponentially big, because this is some kind of picture of how things are connected in Hilbert space. But it's a process that's described by a sparse Hamiltonian. So, you know, what this is basically showing you is that this model of the dynamics of sparse Hamiltonians is a model whose computational power is exactly the same as the quantum circuit model. Right? So you can simulate, you know, I showed before how you can simulate sparse Hamiltonians with quantum circuits, and now I'm showing you how you can simulate quantum circuits with the dynamics of sparse Hamiltonians, and in fact, sparse Hamiltonians where all of the entries are just 0 or 1. And they're not just any sparse Hamiltonians, they're actually 3 sparse. Okay, so this shows that in principle, we can do any quantum computation by a quantum walk of a very restricted form. And so this shows that this model is one that's computationally powerful. And this is, you know, maybe some additional motivation for thinking about quantum walks as a framework for developing quantum algorithms. So not just, you know, we're not just thinking necessarily here about quantum walks in general, but there's this particular framework of scattering on graphs that you might think would be useful for designing algorithms, not just for translating generic algorithms from the circuit model to this model of quantum walks, but for coming up with algorithms in the first place. And in fact, I've already shown you an example where that was done, right? So this algorithm for formula evaluation was motivated by this idea of scattering on graphs. And you know, so this is nice. We can think about this as an algorithmic technique. But one thing which is maybe not as nice about this is that what we get out of this is not really something that we can think about as an architecture for how to build a quantum computer, right? Because the graph is necessarily exponentially big. It's some kind of picture of how things are connected in Hilbert space, not how some qubits are connected together. So you could ask, well, could we do something like this, but where we could really view the graph as some kind of picture of how to put together a quantum computer? So that's the last thing that I want to tell you about. And this relates to the idea of a generalization of quantum walk, where we have many walkers. Right? So far, we've seen the setting where you have a single walker that can move around on the graph. But what if we have many particles that live on a graph, and they can move around according to the, you know, whatever the structure of the graph is, but they also interact, right? So if two particles find themselves at the same vertex, there's some local interaction that allows them to do something different than if they were there by themselves. And you know, this allows you to represent high-dimensional systems, of course, with a much smaller graph, because if we have, let's say, m distinguishable walkers on an n-vertex graph, now we have n to the m states. So now we can have a number of states that's exponentially large with a graph that's only polynomially big. So now we potentially could think about the graph as a picture of how to build a device. And this is something that we've actually shown. So, you know, if you take a general quantum circuit, you can simulate that by a quantum walk on a polynomial-sized graph with a polynomial number of walkers and where the walk runs for a polynomial amount of time. So this gives you, you know, first of all, a proof that this is a model, this model that people haven't considered so much, but maybe should start to consider from an algorithmic perspective, that this is a computationally powerful model. And it also gives you a new way to potentially think about how you would build a quantum computer. You know, another way of saying this is that this problem of simulating the dynamics of many-body systems on, you know, in some kind of fairly generic scenario where, let's say, we consider systems of particles interacting on graphs, this is a BQP hard problem, right? So if you want to simulate, for example, the dynamics of the Bose-Hubbard model on a, you know, sparse unweighted graph, and I haven't explained this, but in fact you can even restrict these graphs to be planar. So you know, you can consider, for example, the Bose-Hubbard model on a very simple kind of graph, and nevertheless the dynamics of those systems are BQP hard, which means they're as hard as anything that you could solve with a quantum computer. Right, so that suggests, in particular, that we're unlikely to be able to simulate those dynamics efficiently with classical computers. All right, so you know, the basic idea of how this works is to combine some of the ideas I already mentioned from the single particle universality construction with a way of implementing a different way of implementing two qubit gates using some kind of momentum dependent routing. So we have some kind of a graph that will route particles in one of two different ways depending upon their momenta. And using that kind of gadget, we construct something that allows the particles to interact in different ways, depending upon whether we have, you know. So what basically happens in this apparatus is that if we have let's say the state 0, 0, then we'll have two particles and they'll just go straight through. If we have the state 0, 1, then again, the particles will just go through without interacting with each other. So the 0 particle is up here, the 1 particle will go this way, and nothing will happen. But if we're in the 1, 1 state, then what will happen is that the particles will be routed toward each other. So they'll go along these two paths, and they'll interact somewhere in this region. And then this interaction will cause some relative phase to occur that will allow us to perform something like a controlled Z gate. Okay? And then the particles will be routed back into the appropriate places, and then we have our logical encoding back. So this is some way of performing 2-qubit gates where we encode the state of 2 qubits in a state where we have 2 particles. And in general, if we have we want to have some n-qubit system, we can encode that using n particles. Okay, so using this sort of idea and some, you know, fairly extensive analysis to show that the errors are actually well-bounded when you try to do this sort of thing, you can show that this strategy works. Okay, so you know, I've hopefully convinced you that this idea of quantum walk that's been developed over the years is a powerful algorithmic tool, and I mentioned these you know, 3 different applications: formula evaluation, simulating Hamiltonian dynamics, and performing universal quantum computation. These are just a few of the examples of where quantum walk has been useful, and it's actually been useful in many other ways. So just to finish up, I just want to stop with a little bit of, you know, finish with a little bit of outlook on you know, quantum algorithms and quantum computing in general. So, you know, a question that people often ask me is, you know, when will we have large-scale quantum computers? These algorithms sound great. You know, when can we actually run them? And, you know, I think this is the right answer. So, you know, there's this quote that's sometimes attributed to Bohr that prediction is very difficult, especially when it's about the future. So, you know, it's hard to say when we'll have large-scale devices, you know, that where we can actually run these algorithms. But in some sense, that's maybe not the right question, right? I mean, there are lots of interesting things that that we can be doing now. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be trying to build quantum computers, but there are really, I think, a lot of interesting theory questions that that need to be addressed that will help us to understand really just, you know, what is the computational power of quantum mechanics. So, you know, there are practical questions like, you know, how can we design cryptosystems that resist quantum attacks, right? We know that the RSA cryptosystem is broken by Shor's algorithm. What other sorts of cryptosystems might we design that perhaps wouldn't have that sort of problem? You know, how efficiently can quantum computers simulate quantum systems, right? So I talked about some simulation algorithms that give us some improvements over, you know, previously known simulation algorithms, but there's room for further improvement and for better understanding how we can simulate particular kinds of quantum systems. More generally, you know, a big question that motivates me is this question of just what are the sorts of problems that have fast quantum algorithms? This is really something that is not well understood. Probably would be very hard to have any kind of general understanding of, but I think we have the potential to at least understand the answer to this question a lot better by thinking about it. And you know, we would also like to kind of expand the toolbox for quantum algorithms, so come up with other tools beyond, you know, for example, the Fourier transform, which has been very useful in this idea of quantum walk that I've talked about today. You know, what other sorts of tools could we develop that would be useful for building quantum algorithms? And we'd also like to understand what sorts of problems are hard, even for quantum computers, something that I haven't really addressed today too much. But, you know, this problem of understanding the limitations of quantum computers, I think, is also very important from the standpoint of understanding what it is that they're good at. Okay, so I think I'll stop there, but thanks for your attention.
Fact you mentioned that you have your, in the quantum case, the same speed up regardless of the formula, that's correct?
Yes, in the classical case, very event, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas in the classical case, you have variable speed up depending on what formula you consider.
Yes.
This is a very remarkable fact.
Yes.
Could one imagine using it to sort of to motivate why nature should be quantum instead of classical, that it has this?
Because there should be a nice answer to this question of, you know, what's the complexity of evaluating formula. I suppose one could try to make that argument. I guess you would have to take a poll to, you know, figure out how plausible people think that is as an argument for why quantum mechanics should be the way it is. I think maybe it's, you know, perhaps not as compelling as, for example, you know, we could ask why quantum mechanics isn't nonlinear, and you know, we know, for example, that if we have nonlinearities in quantum mechanics, that would allow us to do things like solve NP-complete problems, you know, in polynomial time, which is maybe a more implausible thing to think about than, you know, that evaluating different Boolean formulas could have different complexities, right? So I would say the strength of that argument as a reason why quantum mechanics should not be nonlinear is maybe more than,
right,
you know, this other argument. But I hear what you're saying.
The same question is can you pinpoint what it is about quantum theory that makes it have this property that isn't true of classical case?
It's a good question, but I don't think I have a.
It just turns out.
Yeah. I mean, there's this algorithm, and you can analyze it, and you know, this is the complexity. But I'm not sure that I can explain it in a more concise way than that.
Scattering and graphs. Is this something that people have tried to look at for classical algorithms? Because this sounds very different from the usual, let's try to see how quickly it converges to steady state distributions as functions of spectrum or something. Like, I mean, it sounds like it could be useful for classical algorithms as well.
Well, this is usually what happens when you when you think about a random process on a graph. You know, the thing will just mix to its uniform distribution, and so you won't get this, you know, this kind of information out of it. I mean, there are these sorts of models, you know, which you can think of maybe as some kind of analogs of these, of, you know, billiard ball computers, where you can think about designing a computer by the way some, you know, maybe, you know, hard spheres bounce off of each other, and you can design some, you know, ways of positioning them in space initially and having them bounce off of things so that you can perform logic gates. And, you know, there are papers about these sorts of models of reversible computation, which, you know, sounds like it's kind of in the spirit of the sort of things you're talking about. But I don't know examples where these kinds of ideas have been used to find classical algorithms that maybe you wouldn't think about in other ways, you know, where you really think about this as an algorithmic tool.
In the beginning, you had one slide that was about, you know, where the power of quantum computation comes from.
Right.
You suggested that, you know, the reason we couldn't use classical interference to do this is because you'd need an exponentially large quantum.
Right.
And by the end, it's clear that if we had just a single walker in the random walk paradigm, we would also need an exponentially large quantum.
Right.
So it seems like the difference is more about, you know, these interacting walkers.
Mm-hmm.
So just, can you be more precise about what you think the power of quantum computation comes from, given that many walker paradigm? So what would be wrong with a sort of classical interference device, you know, wave-like device that tried to emulate or many walkers, quantum walk?
Right. Well, I think if you wanted to do that, you would still have to describe, you know, you would still have to somehow effectively describe this exponentially large state space, right? So if you think about the space of these many walkers, I mean, it's an exponentially large state space. And if you wanted to describe that, you know, have some classical system that would have that many degrees of freedom, it would have to be an exponentially big thing. Right. I mean, if you just described, have a bunch of oscillators and that's described by, say, you know, n classical particles, then if you want to say what the states of these n oscillators are, you just need, you know, n variables. Right. So if you have some polynomial number of oscillators that are coupled in, you know, even some potentially very complicated way, you still can say what the state of the system is using only polynomially many degrees of freedom. So, I mean, to me, you know, what I would say about the power of quantum computers is that, you know, we can have this interference occurring in an exponentially large state space, and that's just something that we can't do with classical degrees of freedom. You don't look convinced, though.
No. So, n rocks in the pond is not the same as n quantum particles.
Right. That's right. Definitely not.
So this quantum walk stochastic, it is from another classical stochastic equation to the quantum case, but it becomes Schrodinger equation. And
right.
I think it's like just a deterministic equation. It's no longer stochastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's described by a very similar looking equation, but it's now not the dynamics of a probability distribution, but it's the dynamics of a quantum state. And yeah, I mean, this small change makes all the difference.
In discrete case, it seems that you once can use the, I mean, you use the coin, and then
yes,
this time it becomes stochastic again.
No, I mean, still then you would have a kind of a coherent quantum mechanical process where you would have to describe the system by quantum amplitudes. Yeah.
So, like, the way you describe the quantum is that you still have some Hamiltonian and unitary transformation, but you, instead of like applying the unitary transformation continuously, you just apply it like step by step.
Right, you wouldn't have a Hamiltonian in one of these discrete time quantum walk processes. You would just have some unitary operator that somehow would respect the locality of the graph, so it would only move amplitudes around in a way that's local with respect to the graph. And you would just kind of, you know, hit the system with that unitary operator again and again and again, and that's just taking steps of the walk.
Okay.